The first time people talked about reparations for slavery, they talked about land. 40 acres and a mule.
Something that was really powerful that I learned recently is that in 1865, when General Sherman met with about 30 black clergy to find out what it was that they needed after the war ended, they said, and I quote, "We need homes and the grounds beneath them so we can plant fruit trees and say to our children, these are ours."
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. That dream of owning land, growing food to feed your family and your neighbors, maybe it's not so old-fashioned even today. What if reparations were finally paid right now as land? Would anyone want it? Well, meet Leah Panama.
Land really is the basis of everything. Without land, we can't build our homes, we can't grow our food, have our businesses, have security for the future. I grew up in a rural town called Ashburnham, Massachusetts. I was mostly raised by my father, along with my two siblings, Naima and Alan. Like most kids without a lot of means, you got to get a summer job as soon as you are of age so you can pay for your stuff and save for college and all that. So I got a job at the Food Project outside of Boston when I was 16. And being a teenager is complicated. Being a teenager who identifies as black and was raised in this rural town is even more complicated. And farming is elegantly simple. You put a seed, you tend it, you harvest it, you feed the community. It's good. No one can tell you it's not good. And that was the kind of rock that I needed in those challenging times. I was hooked. I kept farming and I haven't stopped for 23 years.
Leah Panaman is founding co-director of Soulfire Farm in Grafton, New York. It's a working and teaching farm. She and her partner raise vegetables, chickens, eggs, and social justice. Now, on this continent, land has been a source of generational trauma since the arrival of the first Europeans. But land can also be a place of healing. For farmers like Leah Panaman, it's a place to reclaim her own African roots. Steve Paulson wanted to talk with her about her path to farming.
Leah, you have talked about yourself as someone who tends the soil, which is a phrase I love. What does that mean to you, to tend the soil?
You know, soil to me is alive. She's a conscious, sovereign, living being. And when I was living in Ghana, West Africa, the Queen Mothers, who were my mentors there, really admonished farmers in the United States, saying, is it true that a farmer will put a seed in the ground and not pray or sing or dance or even say thank you to the soil? I admitted that that was the case, and they said, that's why you're all sick. You're all sick because you take and take and take and don't give back and don't ask permission. So I really see my relationship with the soil as one of reciprocity and reverence.
What does that mean, that the soil or the earth is alive?
Well, in Afro-Indigenous cosmology, whether you're among the Yoruba people or the Dahomey people, we really believe that the earth is what's called an orisha, which is a spirit. One of the names of the earth is Ile Aye. And the idea is that the earth is the same way a tree or a wolf or a human being or a star is, has consciousness and is desiring of being in relationship with us.
Now, you mentioned that you spent time in Ghana, and I read somewhere that you actually had a dream about planting maize. Is that right?
I love that you're getting into the spiritual piece. Yeah. So I'll try to make this not too long-winded because it was quite a journey. But a big turning point for me when I was living in Ghana, I was there for 6 months as a 21-year-old, was a night that I had a dream of planting maize on this mountain that I could see on the horizon. And I told my friend about this dream, and there were words in it I didn't understand. So I said the words, and he said, well, those are the old Krobo, the old language we don't speak anymore. So I'm going to take you to the priest and get the dream interpreted. So long story short, what the priest said is that basically your people are from here, from this particular ethnic group, the Krobo of eastern region of Ghana, because you can't plant maize on that mountain unless you're from here. And so I want you to be initiated and then eventually to become a queen mother, a spiritual leader in our community, and take our teachings back to the United States.
Wow.
So I did.
That's kind of incredible. I mean, you have this dream and it's sort of your life direction comes out of that. So you mentioned that you started this farm, Soul Fire Farm. Why did you want to start a farm?
You know, I fell in love with farming as a teenager, so there was never a question that I would one day have my own farm. But the real causal event was when my partner, Joan, and I were living in the south end of Albany, New York, back in 2005. We had a newborn and a two-year-old, and we were super motivated to feed our children, you know, healthy, fresh vegetables and fruits. We had advanced degrees. We knew how to work the system. And even with that, because there were no grocery stores, farmers markets, public transportation, we encountered huge hurdles. And there was a moment when I realized that we actually, as a community, need to feed ourselves. We can't just rely on the, quote, system to feed us. We need to start a farm that's about feeding ourselves, training others to feed themselves, bringing food back to the South End, to that neighborhood. And so in 2006, we signed White Man's Papers and bought the land and started to farm. And it has grown beyond anything I could have ever imagined, from not just a farm that provides food doorstep delivery to people in the South End and other neighborhoods, but a real ground zero for the training of the next generation of Black and brown farmers.
What you described in the South End of Albany, a lot of people call that a food desert.
So yes, the government would call a neighborhood without grocery stores a food desert. My mentor, Karen Washington, taught me to use the term food apartheid instead, because a desert is a natural phenomena. And apartheid is a human-created system of segregation that relegates certain people to abundance of resources and others to scarcity. And that's really what we have today because of a legacy of racism, of redlining, of unfair zoning, neighborhoods that are quite segregated in terms of access to food.
We should talk about that because there used to be a lot of Black farmers in America, and there aren't anymore.
Yeah, despite the broken promise of 40 acres and a mule, you know, Black farmers managed to purchase almost 16 million acres of land by 1910 and run their own farms. And this was such a threat to the sharecropping way of life in the South that they were met with swift retribution. The White Caps, the Ku Klux Klan, later the White Citizens Council, started a domestic terrorism campaign against Black farmers and killed 4,500 people, burned their houses, and lynchings and cross burnings and shooting at people.
Because they didn't want Black farmers to own land to grow their own food?
Exactly. So if Black farmers own their own land, not only are they opting out of sharecropping, which means there's no labor for the white plantations, but also they're disrupting the white supremacy status quo. They're getting too uppity, right? And the government was completely in collusion with this. You know, in 1965, the U.S. Committee on Civil Rights found that the U.S. Department of Agriculture was the number one driver of Black land loss because it would punish Black folks who were attempting to register to vote, to join the NAACP, to have their own businesses, by denying them loans, denying them crop insurance and crop allotments and all of these other benefits that white farmers were getting. Pete Daniel talks about the government programs, farming programs, being sharpened into a weapon to punish civil rights activity in the 1960s. And so you see a decline from Black farmers having 14% of the nation's farms to just over 1% today, which is certainly no accident of history.
But you mentioned what was happening during the civil rights movement. Obviously, there still were Black farmers. And in fact, they played a pretty crucial role in a lot of what was happening during the civil rights in like the 50s and 60s. They sort of became this refuge, this safe space for a lot of those civil rights activists.
Oh, my goodness. It's so astounding. You know, one of my mentors, Donald Halfkenny, explained this so well. He said, you know, without Black farmers, there would have been no civil rights movement at all. Because you think about being a freedom rider, going down to register people to vote, it's not like you could rent a conference center or eat at a restaurant. you needed a refuge. And so Black farmers provided the meeting space. They provided the armed protection. They leveraged their land as collateral to bail people out of jail. They fed people. They fixed their shoes. They kept a lookout and would cut down a tree to block the road if the night riders were coming after you. So quite literally, there would be no civil rights movement without landowning Black farmers. And that's something we think about a lot. Malcolm X said that land is the basis of freedom, justice, and equality. And so how do we, as landowning Black and brown farmers, really use our land to leverage freedom even beyond the food space?
And yet this history is, of course, even more complicated given the history of slavery, because I would assume that a lot of African Americans would look at farming as kind of this holdover of the whole history of enslavement and then later sharecropping. And to work the land conjures up images of picking cotton on plantations.
Oh, you're so right. And I will tell you time and again, when Black folks first come to Soulfire Farm and make a word association, they think about slavery, even though that's obviously not what's happening. And my friend Chris Bolden Newsom, who's a Black farmer in Philly, explains it so well. He says, the land was the scene of the crime. And I would add, though, that she was never the criminal. In fact, she was probably the reason we survived, our connection with the land, our connection with the bones and wisdom of our ancestors beneath the land. And so when we did flee those red clays of Georgia for good reason, we fled those cross burnings and people trying to take our lands and our dignity and went to the paved streets of Boston and Pittsburgh, we still left a little piece of our souls and our culture behind. And my generation is being called the returning generation that's going to claim the best of that connection to land and rewrite the story so that it's one of dignity and belonging and not circumscribed by the oppression that our ancestors experienced.
So do you still hear that from people? I mean, part of what you do on your farm is you train a new generation of Black and brown farmers. Is there sort of this sort of visceral response? Well, why would I want to do that? Look at the history.
I think mostly from young people, you know, when school children come out on their field trips, they didn't necessarily decide to come to a farm. So yeah, their first visceral reaction is, wait, I don't pick cotton anymore. You know, my parents and grandparents have ran far away from that. But I will tell you that of the thousands and thousands of youth that have come to our farm, every single one leaves with a smile and being happy about burritos and being happy about the land. And I have children asking me if they can have their birthday parties on the farm. So there's something very, very powerful about seeing that people who look like them are not only living their dreams, running their own businesses, defining their own lives, but that they've claimed a connection to the land. And I remember in particular, one young man, Dijor Carter, who's an Albany resident, coming out to the land very, very skeptical, didn't want to get out of the van, afraid that a bear would eat him. And then at the end of the tour saying, you know, miss, this is going to sound weird, but when I put my foot on the ground, I felt my grandmother's spirit come up through my foot, come into my heart, and reminded me that when I was little, we gardened together and she would put a worm in my hands and tell me it was okay. I didn't think I had anything to do with this place. But I'm realizing now I have everything to do with this place. Like, I have everything to do with land and the earth and food and, you know. He got a little teary. The other kids got a little teary talking about their grandmas. But I think it's moments like that where we realize that the colonizers, the oppressors, so to speak, can take a lot from us. But ultimately, we can't let them take our sacred connection to something that has been so central to our identity for thousands of years.
Yeah. It's so interesting what you're saying, because there's a lot of different kinds of social justice movements. We tend not to also talk about that in the context of owning land. So what do you do on the Soulfire Farm? What kind of food do you grow?
Yeah, so we're busy out at Soulfire Farm. We grow a whole lot of things. We grow vegetables, fruits, we raise chickens for eggs and meats, mushrooms, fish pond. So real diversified, because we are a training farm and we want to make sure that folks who come can learn a lot of different models and systems for what they might grow in the future. We have programs almost every day. Our most popular is called BIPOC Fire, which is quite a mouthful, but it's Black Indigenous People of Color Farming in Relationship with Earth. And it's a residential week-long course in all the basics of farming, from seed to marketing, and also addresses methods for healing from the trauma of land-based oppression and celebrating the food sovereignty movements of our ancestors. So there's a lot of singing, clapping, dancing, cooking, along with how to analyze your soil test.
That was Leah Penniman talking with Steve Paulson. She's the author of Farming While Black, Soulfire Farm's Practical Guide to Liberation on the Land, and she tends the soil of Soulfire Farm in New York State.